The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
The first things people would say when they found out that I was new in town is like, oh, did you go see the bats yet? I'm like, what do you mean, see the bats? They're like, oh, yeah, the world's largest urban bat colony here in Austin, a mile from the state capitol. Austin's also the capital of Texas, and that's on Congress Avenue. And 2 miles down Congress Avenue from the state capitol is this bridge over Lake Travis. And they refurbished it in 1982 and with these concrete box beams that created these narrow gaps under the bridge so that the concrete could expand and retract during the wintertime without cracking. It was like a engineering innovation. And it was they accidentally discovered that these narrow gaps ended up creating the perfect bat roost because it's narrow enough for these bats to crawl into the gaps backwards and predators can't reach them. And it also stays kind of a mean temperature. Wind doesn't get in there. And it ended up being like a perfect bat hotel. And so overnight, these bats, millions of bats, like over a million bats, moved into this bridge in the middle of downtown. And every night at sunset, they would leave the bridge all at once to feed, and the sky would be filled with a million bats, and it freaked everybody out.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. As ever, I am your grateful host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance. Number one New York Times bestselling novelist and screenwriter Ernest Cline spoke to me about what inspired him to become a novelist, the success of Ready Player One, and his love letter to Austin, Texas, the mostly true tall tale, Bridge to Bat City. Ernie is the best-selling author of Ready Player One, Ready Player Two, and Armada, and co-screenwriter of the film adaptation of Ready Player One, directed by Steven Spielberg. His debut middle grade novel, Bridge to Bat City, on sale April 9, 2024, is described as a mostly true tall tale about a recently orphaned girl and her mission to help a family of displaced bats find a new home under the Congress Avenue Bridge in Austin, Texas. Ernie's books have been published in over 50 countries and have spent more than 100 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. In the second half of this file, Ernie and I discussed the crazy story behind Stephen King's Misery, what it was like waiting for a call from Steven Spielberg, how the author got to see his fiction turned into reality, making the transition from adult sci-fi to middle grade novels, his shout outs to E.T., Roald Dahl, Charles Portis, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us.
Like, I always think of Stephen King would always write us, his characters are always writers or school teachers, because those are the two jobs that he's ever had. But you would like go back, and I think like 90% of Stephen King's protagonists are school teachers or writers or both. And it works. And he knows the world of being a high school teacher inside and out. And you need that. You know, you could bring that authenticity of your real world experience to your writing, whatever that is.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I was thinking specifically of Misery for some reason, but
oh yeah. Do you know the crazy story behind Misery is that Stephen King was in New York. I think he had finished one of his manuscripts and he was taking it to New York, and he was doing book signings there, and multiple book signings in New York, and this weird guy showed up at all the book signings, waited in line, had a ton of stuff to sign, and then would follow him around after the signing and kept saying, "I'm your biggest fan. I'm your number one fan.
Oh God.
I'm your number one fan." And Stephen King remembered this guy. I remember the way he looked. He had really thick glasses and like a weird, weird dude. Stephen King goes home to Maine. And then the next day sees this guy's face all over the news because it's Mark David Chapman. And he had just shot John Lennon.
Oh, God.
So that Stephen King's brush with Mark David Chapman ended up being his number one fan, ended up being the inspiration for Misery.
Oh,
like, isn't that crazy?
I didn't know that.
No, it's amazing to me how like, little ripples like that can affect literature and fiction. And you know, Kathy Bates gets an Oscar for an amazing performance in the film adaptation. All of those, you know, from this weird encounter that he has at a book signing in New York. You never know. I had this thought when I was in London on the set of Ready Player One, watching them use cranes and welding torches to build the stacks for real. In my novel, I imagine this kind of Blade Runner futuristic trailer park where the trailers are stacked vertically. They build like a framework and then stack the trailer. Because I grew up in trailer parks, another thing from my real life, and was actually in a tornado, was literally tornado bait. And got hit by a tornado when I was a year old. But what? So tornadoes, trailer parks, I have negative associations with them. And I was like, what could be worse than a trailer park? Oh, a stacked trailer park where they're stacked like 10, 20 deep towers of stacked trailers. So that's where my protagonist lives, is in this set of stacked trailers outside Oklahoma City. And it was fun to imagine it. I just wrote, you know, it was a few paragraphs I wrote in the novel. And then cut to 7-8 years later, and they're producing the movie and building these things for real in London. Because I had wrote those words and imagined this thing, now there are people with like welding torches building this thing. And you could see it from the freeway. People driving to work in London could see these like stacked trailers and knew they were making Ready Player One. So I don't know. All of that was a kind of a abject lesson for me, and like the power of imagining things. Now it's kind of scary to sit down at my keyboard when I'm working on something and I know it could be a movie. I'm like, what are people going to have to build? And you have to put all that out of your mind, and like, what would make the best story, and what's the best fodder for the reader's imagination, you know? And you can't think about the movie adaptation until later. Yes. Anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go off on tangents.
No, I like it. Well, yeah, it's very cool. It's very inspiring. It's a very inspiring story, all told. And of course, it's kind of interesting timing. You sold the novel Ready Player One, and then the film rights were sold like almost immediately, right? And
yeah, before the book even came out. Before, just there was a bidding war for the book, and then a few days later, because of that bidding war, there was a bidding war in Hollywood over the movie rights, which ended up going to Warner Brothers, which was amazing. And then I got to write the first few drafts of the screenplay. Which was also an amazing experience, but that was before, you know, we knew who the director was going to be. But, you know, that was an amazing part of the process, is when Steven Spielberg came on board. You know, he read all my drafts of the screenplay and Zach's draft, and then, you know, started over and started making his version of Ready Player, which is unbelievable, right? Like after I said that, like everything that you wouldn't want to happen when you make your first movie happened to me with Fanboys, but everything you would want to happen when you publish your first novel did happen to me with Ready Player One, like one after the other. And that was like, after I sold the movie rights, I'm like, wow, no, it couldn't get any better than this. And then the director is announced, and it's the greatest director of all time. And one of my childhood heroes, and the, you know, the guy who made all the Indiana Jones movies and E.T. and Close Encounters, just crazy. Those 2 weeks are the longest 2 weeks of my life when he was deciding. They told me he was reading it and that he was going to decide, and it was 2 weeks. And after a first few days, I decided, well, there's no way he's ever going to do this. And this is awful, because now I'm going to have to spend the rest of my life imagining what it would have been like if Steven Spielberg had made Ready Player One. But luckily he did do it, and then I don't have to.
Amazing.
Imagine. Yeah, the answer is awesome.
Yeah. Well, then, of course, fast forward to this premiere at South by Southwest, which must have been just truly thrilling for you.
It was, but it's also kind of a nightmare because this sound cut out. Do you know this story? The sound cut out? What? Yeah. They had not tested the audio. There's a moment in Ready Player One when the shield around Castle Anorak is blown up, and it really makes this loud explosion sound. Well, this sound kept breaking the audio system in the Paramount Theater that night. So the sound would cut out. So they stopped the movie. This is the climax of the movie, by the way. So they stopped the movie and rewound it. It took 5 minutes while everybody's losing their mind and running to the bathroom and coming back. And then they started again, get to that moment, boom, sound cuts out again. And so everybody's again losing their mind. They rewind it a third time. And is it going to work? And this time it works, and the sound stays on, and people are able to watch the end of the movie. But that, and then it was like euphoric. People were so glad. I think it helped.
Oh my God.
The response was amazing. Ben Mendelsohn has said it was the greatest screening of any movie he's ever been in his life because the people lost their mind. But it was a crazy night. But I think because of that, because of the gaffe with the audio, then Steven decided he should get up and say a few words afterwards. So then Steven Spielberg got up in my town in front of all my friends and family. And, you know, and then the whole cast was there too. That was what was amazing is even more amazing. They made the Ready Player One experience, which was like an interactive recreation of my book or of the movie in downtown Austin. They also did this at the corner of Hollywood and Vine in Los Angeles. When the movie premiered out there, they built these, a giant interactive experience, like a amusement park like thing where people could walk through sets from the movie and pick up props. And then they built it again in South by Southwest. Just again, like what they built a giant recreation of the Iron Giant here in Austin at the Ready Player One experience. And my friend Tim McCandless, who wrote the Iron Giant, I invited him down and he got to see, he couldn't believe that there was so much more. There was no, not even a premiere for the Iron Giant when the movie came out. But when Ready Player One came out, there was this like celebration of everybody who loved the Iron Giant. And so I got to experience that with him, the screenwriter of the Iron Giant. It was pretty cool. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, these are all incredible stories. Thanks for sharing the premiere story about the audio guy. Now that must have been harrowing, but of course.
Man. Yeah, but it worked out. It all worked out.
It all worked out somehow. Well, yeah, I mean, of course, you've gone on to this prolific career and you're kind of making a shift now. I mean, I want to shift to what you got cooking right now with Bridge to Bat City. And of course, it's described as a mostly true tall tale about a recently orphaned girl and her mission to help a family of displaced bats find a new home. Based on, you know, based on some truth here, obviously, there is... some historical stuff going on here and nods to Austin. And yeah, talk a little bit about the inspiration behind it because it's a really cool.
Yeah, well, it's my first middle grade fiction novel. So I guess that's like the age range is like 9 to 13. But it's, I tried to, you know, the story was kind of inspired by Roald Dahl and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Fantastic Mr. Fox and Charlotte's Web, stories like that. I love kind of fables with anthropomorphic animals like that. And always wanted to, you know, try writing something like that. But the idea never occurred to me until I moved to Austin. And as soon as I moved here, one of the first things people would say when they found out that I was new in town is like, oh, did you go see the bats yet? I'm like, what do you mean see the bats? They're like, oh yeah, the world's largest urban bat colony here in Austin, a mile from the state capital. Austin's also the capital of Texas. And that's on Congress Avenue. And 2 miles down Congress Avenue from the state capitol is this bridge over Lake Travis. And they refurbished it in 1982 and with these concrete box beams that created these narrow gaps under the bridge so that the concrete could expand and retract during the wintertime without cracking. It was like a engineering innovation. And it was they accidentally discovered that these narrow gaps ended up creating the perfect bat roost because it's narrow enough for these bats to crawl into the gaps backwards and predators can't reach them. And it also stays kind of a mean temperature. Wind doesn't get in there. And it ended up being like a perfect bat hotel. And so overnight, these bats, millions of bats, like over a million bats moved into this bridge in the middle of downtown. And every night at sunset, they would leave the bridge all at once to feed and the sky would be filled with a million bats and it freaked everybody out in Austin. The bridge is actually right next to the local newspaper offices, the Austin American Statesman. They ran a big front page story, bats sink teeth into city. It was like vampire bats invade Austin. Like these things all have rabies. We need to do something. And a lot of people like started a movement to get rid of them, eradicate these bats. And they were going to use flamethrowers to burn them out and then set up nets over the gaps in the bridge so that they could never get back in. But then there was kind of a movement started by this bat conservationist named Merlin Tuttle, who's a character in my book, is a real guy. And he lives here in Austin has become a friend of mine. But Merlin saw the news about Austin. It got picked up by the national media that this town down in Texas, the state capital, had been invaded by vampire bats. And he was a bat conservationist, I think, living up in Illinois. And he decided to pack up his things and move to Austin because he saw that this was a huge opportunity to teach people that bats are really beneficial to humans because of all the insects they eat, especially mosquitoes and crop pests. Bats eat their own body weight in insects every night, and so they're hugely beneficial. And in Austin, which is like a city of outdoor music venues, like these bats coming to town was actually one of the best things that could ever happen. It made it much more pleasant to be outside in Austin, listening to bands at South by Southwest and every outdoor concert. It was just made it a better city. It's also really good for everybody's gardens. But the crazy thing is it ended up becoming a huge tourist attraction. People began to gather on the bridge every night to watch the bats and people coming from out of town. And now it makes like $30, $40 million a year for Austin, people just coming to town. So when I first time I went and saw the bats and learned this story, it was a really powerful experience to see like these, you know, these creatures pour out and fly up into the sky. And it's like the starlings murmuration, you know, they have these emergent properties that happen once they get up in the air around each other, like a flock of birds. It's really beautiful and experience. But when I found out like, oh, these guys were an invasive species that were not welcome here in town. And I love that the species of these bats, it was Mexican free-tail bats. So they're Mexican bats. It's even worse. These are Mexican bats that are moving into our our habitat. Like it's humans' habitat that have been invaded by bats. And so the humans want to drive them out. When in my story, the bats all live in a cave they lived in for thousands of years that then gets destroyed by humans who are making a limestone quarry. This would happen a lot. Limestone quarries and other human development will destroy bats' habitat. Nobody knows where the bats under the bridge in Austin came from, but so I kind of created this fable, the story about this girl whose family farm is right next to the bats' cave, and she loses her mother and has to go live on the family farm. And it's right as the farm is about to be bought out by this limestone company, and they're also destroying the bats' home, the cave. And so the bats become homeless the same time as this little girl. And it's kind of partly inspired by Elliot and E.T. and their psychic link. But this little girl has a UFO sighting. So this story, Bridge to Bat City, is kind of a stealth science fiction story too. People think it's a departure for me, but this is a science fiction story too. This little girl has a UFO sighting at the family farm, and she has some missing time. And then after the next morning, she finds out that she has a psychic link to the bats. She's able to communicate telepathically with the bats in the cave. And then when the bats lose their home and she and her uncle lose their home, the family farm, then they kind of throw their lots in together and convince the bats to follow them to Austin, which is this, you know, where all their favorite music is. And they all watch Austin City Limits every week and dream of Austin. And this is kind of the dream of everyone in Texas. If you grow up weird or loving music in Texas, which is a big state with a lot of little towns, with not a lot going on. And everybody who grows up in one of those towns dreams of going to Austin and like attending UT and Austin's the big city. And it's kind of the epicenter of the counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
Austin is they call it the blueberry and the tomato soup. It's like the one liberal city in Texas. It's the one city that fights back against kind of the rest of Texas's attitudes.
For sure.
Which is what's beautiful because this is also the state capital. So all these lawmakers have to come to Austin and be surrounded by all these, you know, hippies and people like me with opposing viewpoints. So the Austin is where the rubber meets the road. It's a really interesting place. And like you said, it has changed a lot, but this is kind of my love letter to old Austin, which was before I even got here. You know, it's kind of the mythical land of Oz was the way that Austin was described to me by people who had lived here in the 80s. So, and the 80s is when the bats moved in. And so I kind of take 10 years of the bats winning over Austin and condense it down into one summer and have everything that ever happened cool in Austin, you know, from Willie Nelson, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and everybody, you know, all the different amazing concerts that we had here during the 80s. I kind of condensed them all into this one mostly true tall tale about the weirdest town in Texas. So cool. Was my subtitle for it. So, and you know, it was only the only idea for a children's story I'd ever had, and it was my own children, kind of spending a lot of time reading to my own children during the pandemic. And I was like, you know, somebody, I always thought somebody would do a story about the bats, because it was such a natural idea for like a Pixar movie or something, but no one ever did. And I decided it was going to be me. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to write this story. And I've, you know, told parts of it to my kids, and I can see how you could pour it into the mold of like James and the Giant Peach was one of my favorite books when I was a kid, and one that I would read over and over again, and also inspired Ready Player One. The reason that Wade, when he's orphaned, has to go live with his Aunt Alice, his mean Aunt Alice, is because when James and James the Giant Peach is orphaned, he has to go live with his mean Aunt Spiker and Aunt Sponge. James the Giant Peach is actually orphaned in the first paragraph of that book. His parents are eaten by a rhinoceros at the zoo in front of him. It's really horrific. Like, that Roald Dahl had really dark, awful stuff. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Like, Willy Wonka, he murders and maims those children one at a time.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Because they don't fit his criteria of being a good kid, watching too much TV or eating too much candy. So he has his death midgets maim and disfigure these children one that's after another. Right. Yeah. That's more the movie than the book, maybe, but I always, that was, I think, why kids love Roald Dahl still, is because there's something dark and a little bit, you know, this shouldn't be at a children's story. And so Bridge to Bat City has that kind of thing in it too. And just the fun of a tall tale of, you know, somebody weaving a lot of colorful BS into their into their retelling of true events.
Right.
was fun too. I'm a big fan of Charles Portis. Especially True Grit is one of my favorite novels, and it's a 13-year, it's told, you know, it's a an older woman recounting this thing that happened when she was 13, when somebody killed her father, and she went into Indian territory to avenge his death and find his murderer and shoot him down. It's like an amazing dark story about a 13-year-old girl, but a really great adventure and amazing use of like the vernacular of Arkansas and Southern language. And that was something I tried to capture in Bridge to Bat City too. People in Texas have a real colorful way of talking that I've, you know, from being from Ohio, I've slowly adopted it over the years. I say y'all now instead of you guys. It used to be you guys, but now it's y'all. What are y'all?
You can't escape it.
What are y'all fixing to do?
you code switch, right?
Right, I do.
That's amazing. All really cool stories. And interesting to hear about that it was inspired by E.T., of course, and a stealth sci-fi tale. But yeah. One of your peers described it as a fun middle grade novel with a very strong narrative voice, lots of great Austin history, and some retro Easter eggs, and even some nods to 80s video games. So, of course, it is Ernest Cline.
Yes.
But yeah, congrats on the work. Of course, a link to Bridge to Bat City, which is coming out April 9th. That's a lot of fun. And I'm sure that your kids are psyched.
Yeah, they're, you know, this was more stories that I told them when they were younger. So I think that it's cool for them to get to see, you know, other kids experience this story that was just kind of our family's story. So it's exciting. Yeah, it's exciting for all of us.
For sure. Well, again, congrats on the work. And I could probably pick your brain all day. I'd love to have you back in the future, but
I'm
kind of imagining a cameo in the film of Bridge to Bat City by Willie Nelson.
I hope you get to hang out with Willie. Oh yeah.
Yeah. What else you got cooking? What are you working on next?
I have a science fiction novel, just a regular adult science fiction novel, standalone, that is not a sequel to anything, that I have been working on for a while. And now I'm kind of taking a break from that to do promotion for this, but I never really stop thinking about it. You know, when you're writing something, you're kind of writing in your head all day, even when you're not at the computer putting it down, you're always thinking about it. So there'll be another science fiction novel coming from me maybe next year. Maybe. We'll see.
Okay. Well, we will look forward to whatever you got cooking, and of course, more regular sci-fi.
Yes.
From Ernie Cline. No, we really appreciate your time and for taking the time to do this today. One final fun question for you.
Sure.
Before we break, and if you could have dinner with any author from any era to your favorite in the world, who would you take?
Man,
where would you take them? Drinks, dinner, whatever. It's all on. It's all on us.
Oh yeah, man. That would have to. It would have to be Kurt Vonnegut. Is for huge for me, a huge influence, and like I love watching recordings of hearing him speak too. So I don't know. I would take him to like a bagel shop near his house in New York, where he lived at the end of his life. I would just love to hear him tell stories. And he seemed there was a great documentary. That Robert Whitey, who was kind of the fan that became a friend of his, and he made a great documentary that kind of gives you that experience of getting to hang out with Kurt Vonnegut and become friends with him. So that would be my choice. Who would be yours? You answered this.
Bagels with Vonnegut.
Oh yeah.
I would like to. Well, I'd like to be a fly on the wall for that one.
That would be good.
There are a few recent ones that I just can't top. I can't top any of the ones that have come before. So, you know, I mean, some of the favorites would be just like hanging out in Paris with, you know, like Hemingway
that's the dream.
Fitz and having drinks or whatever. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. That's what I love about Midnight in Paris. I think a lot of writers have that fantasy, and like, he gets to live out the, you know, fantasy of all those amazing people in Paris in that era.
So such cool. A great movie.
It's a good one. I love time travel movies. Yeah. But man, I had so much fun talking with you. Thank you again for having me on.
Yeah, you too.
This was a good time.
Appreciate you, sir. Come back anytime, and we will chat in the future. And best of luck with the tour for Bridge to Bat City.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll talk soon.
Right on.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.